Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
You're on 101.9 Hi FM, and thank you for joining us. This is the People in Perspective show, and this is Saul Rosenberg speaking. We've just had Craig Berkowitz on the show, who's shared some of his insights about sick leave. Such a tricky, nifty thing that if you are in somebody who has currently gone through an episode where you have had to get some kind of advice, have you gone into a situation where you've had to ask for a certificate, a medical certificate? If you're currently going through any of that kind of thing, you're welcome to send us an SMS or a WhatsApp message on 0618951019. That's 0618951019. If you have any other things that you're sort of interested in discussing or would like us to know about, send us a message. We're only too happy to hear from you. So next up in the main feature segment of the show, we have somebody named Sarah Gon, who's the policy fellow for the Institute of Race Relations. It's very exciting to have her on the show. Sarah's a policy fellow for the Institute of Race Relations, and she has written lots of articles and been in general media on social political topics. And 17 years in the legal profession, Sarah sort of was also part of the Joburg Philharmonic Orchestra, as I see. Experiences basically includes labor hearings and chairing governing bodies and government schools, and she's a trustee as well. Hello, Sarah. Thank you for joining us.
A pleasure, Saul. Thanks.
Sarah, the Institute of Race Relations is one of those things that everyone looks to for guidance in certain instances and in depending on the situation.
Yeah.
It's one of those institutions which has just been there as a sort of, you know, bit of a shining star on the horizon to say, okay, we've got these people around, they can help us. Mm. So in terms of, you know, labor issues, as it were, to try and make it relevant for people, the current perceptions of labor unions, they've always been mixed. You know, so what would you say, you know, the general outlook is towards unions at the moment is in the country?
Well, you see, I think there are differences in the sense that you've got the main player that everyone knows, and that is the ANC's tripartite partner, COSATU.
Yeah.
It's a union federation, and all the so it has numerous trade unions affiliated to it.
Yeah.
But there are a range of other unions that have either a sort of non-political affiliate status or may be affiliated to other political entities, but they are not part of the governing structure.
Mm.
So the philosophy, the ideologies behind them and the things they may or may not do for their members may differ widely.
Mm.
And I suppose it's really our main concern has been the fact that, first and foremost, any trade union must serve its members, which is to protect them and advance their members' employment lives as best as possible. And sometimes it's very necessary. You may have employers who take advantage, who do exploit, who don't follow the law, and that's really what your union primarily is for. Because there are different interests between people in employee level and management of a company and the company itself, and that's been unionization. Is well over 100 years old.
Mm.
And I think the problem is just the fact that as ordinary South Africans, what we do tend to see is very much in the media would be the actions of the COSATU unions.
Yeah.
And that's particularly because currently COSATU largely represents unions active in the public sector. So the spending of our taxes for employee salaries, the negotiation over them and how unions behave in that sector is something we are generally commonly more alert to than unions operating in the private sector.
Yeah, I think that's important for people to know. Generally, the media is very sort of media is hyped anyway. We've got a very vocal civil society. Mm. But you make a good point about the fact that any union that's part of COSATU generally will get a lot of media coverage, whereas a union that's possibly not might not get coverage. Mm. As I understand, the different types of unions, you've got craft unions, general unions, industrial unions. Are there people associate unions with so-called with blue-collar work? But you also get white collar unions as well. But I think,
No, that's exactly right. I think one of the problems in the public sector is there's usually a level at which employees, as they approach the management level, do not become in the private sector don't become eligible to be union members because it is in fact they have to deal with employee issues. From the company's point of view, which may not be in accordance with the unionized employees, and that's the nature of the relationship. Whereas in the public sector, you have people to a very high level in management who are just members of unions. It's completely, for me, I regard it as completely contradictory because you kind of, everyone's arguing against management, and yet management is part of the people, are both part of the entities that are arguing, and the entity that has to counter that argument. So it's not intended only to serve the blue collar workers. I mean, the banking is probably the most familiar white collar sector that one knows has had a very very stable, very strong union presence. Mm-hmm. But management should not be eligible for unionization exactly because they are the party that has to address the circumstances that unions bring to management on behalf of the workforce.
Yeah, so it's a multi-stakeholder process, as far as I understand. Yeah. The legislation, Labor Relations Act, provides for so many sort of mechanisms that enable multi-party negotiation. It's so powerful, that framework, and some days I think it's partially a lot of it's playing a role in holding a lot of the country together, I would say. It's I've never come across something so bold in its undertaking kind of set everybody down at the table and bring everybody together.
Yeah, and look, I think the one thing, and the COSATU unions historically were significant in this, is that at the time during the apartheid era when black employees were not recognized legally as employees and black unions were not recognized, the change was forced on the nationalist government because the economy was now becoming increasingly, it became an issue of unions making forays into the private sector recognizing unions, and obviously for that government, the thought of facing just endless strife because the government would put industry at risk. It's where they started to liberalize. Right. And so the COSATU unions, which became the COSATU unions, so their predecessors essentially played a significant role in the process by which management and unions learned to deal with each other, and quite sophisticatedly in the sense of learning to negotiate and communicate with each other and where the levels of representation should be and not be. And I think to a large extent it's that experience that was brought to the ANC that then became the governing party. They essentially acted to some extent for the ANC while the ANC was still banned. And as a consequence, they provided a lot of the sort of intellectual muscle to the ANC as it moved from being a liberation movement to a political party. And that's really changed. You know, we've had 30 years. That intellectual strength isn't there. What's now, particularly with the establishment of the GNU, what the ANC did when it came to power, having the Communist Party and COSATU as its alliance partners, it served them well for a while, but by sort of freezing out or inhibiting the competition between unions from different environments, from different backgrounds, ideologies, that became a source of contestation and often violence, and one saw it most aggressively in the mining sector.
Yes.
It is not necessarily in the interests of a union to have an ideological point that is not necessarily supported by its membership. So, in other words, membership is really free to have its choose the political direction individuals want to follow, and the union must first and foremost service them. And one of the points I made recently, not entirely tongue-in-cheek, but not sort of very aggressively, is that COSATU should actually be very pleased about the sort of growth-driven positions of the non-ANC parties in the GNU, because if we could grow the economy, you're looking at creating an environment that's good for business. And if people are encouraged to start businesses, they'll employ people. And if the unions want to arrest a decline in membership and stagnation, there are new potential membership available that that's not available in a low growth economy. What I was trying to communicate was that the survival, the development, the growth of unionism now would benefit far more from the growth of the economy than sticking to the ideology that we know from the ANC, SACP, COSATU perspective. I'm not sure I convinced them because the ideology is very strong. But the unions that respond to growth and don't see it as the enemy because it's linked to companies and management growing as well, will remain relevant.
This kind of saying, you know, growth is the white elephant in the room, and you know, and to some extent, it's the fact that people have got different perspectives of what growth means. You know, lots of people are not, you know, in academic circles, they generally tend to lecture against the idea of growth as for growth's sake. You know, it's not a popular idea to say that there should be growth for growth's sake. And that's sort of been linked to the sustainability agenda, which is probably one of the frameworks that could help to bridge some of these gaps which the, you know, labor relations, you know, frameworks try to do. But it's what the individuals who have been given the power to do that, you know, decide that they can do or are able to do, that we often left in these conundrums.
Well, you see, I think part of the problem, there's a sort of historic perceptual issue that always seen as, you know, have seen almost romantically as unions defending the rights of workers and preventing them from being exploited, which is certainly one of the things they have to do, and a capitalist free market society, you know, companies may well try and get away with things, and the legislation, the Labor Relations Act and related legislation is there to limit that abuse.
Yes.
And the learning to negotiate and, you know, get on and manage an environment to the benefit of employees. You know, unionism started in the West. It started as a need for people who were being exploited to have some way to preserve, to build, to challenge for their rights. Now, the problem now is that the legislation is all there. There are companies who contravene, but really not to the extent where it should be an ideological battle first and foremost. It's really about the unions keeping the management to account for the benefit of their members. And sometimes it may be confrontational, but most of the time it should be generally agreeable and cooperative. And it's that sticking with that sort of idea that somehow the workers of the world must unite and, you know, we're saving them from exploitation as a general rule. We are way beyond that. And from the IRR's point of view, sort of everything about turning South Africa around hinges on achieving growth, because all the surveys we've done over the years, we do a sort of socioeconomic survey now pretty much every year. We used to do it less frequently, but you ask people to tell you in surveying them what is their most pressing concern. You don't offer them ideas; they must tell you what their concerns are. And the only concern that is always at the very top of any survey is unemployment. And obviously, not just because people need to survive, but if you don't have employment and you don't have access to working your way up in an environment, your development, what you can provide for your family, the chance to move up from unemployed to working class into the middle class is completely stymied. Obviously, you know, we don't even have to talk about the huge social consequences in other respects. But to know that employment and providing an environment in which people can feed themselves, feed their families, and then better themselves. You know, the successful countries in the world, that's how it works. That's just how it works. That's a natural consequence. And the laws are just there to, largely there to rein in the excesses.
So have we seen a history over the, you know, this, I mean, the tripartite alliance is kind of, you know, where, you know, one of the touch points in the ideological journey between the stakeholders that you've got, members of unions, company owners, government officials, international labor organizations. Historically, you know, there's probably been a fair amount of efficacy, but do you think, you know, the system that we have, the short end of it, you know, that's in place, are we going to see any you know, major change in any sort of different way that we've seen it in the last 15 years or so?
I think there's, particularly from the larger politically powerful unions and Kasatu, I don't think we're going to see much improvement in the way in which relations are conducted. There's no space for growth, because there is a limit as to what you can feasibly afford to do now at the public level with the public service. So the growth in the public service, should there be any growth because skills are needed or because services have to be provided, has a very inherent limitation. If you want to grow the organizations that form incentives for people to create companies, to employ people, for unions to be of relevance to those people, the moribund, as far as I'm concerned, the moribund political philosophy is just not going to serve the country. It's, while you may have a move in areas of the West to the left and to the idea of moving to the utopianism through socialism to communism, it's not the way human nature works. And that's why you tend to find that unless the economy is given the space to grow, even if you still have a huge autocracy like China, but if you don't grow the economy, things just stagnate, and you know, to no good end. I mean, we know that our government, there is much they haven't been able to do. Even now, they're still taking too long to make crucial decisions, and and because of the change from a majority party to a minority party, I think the ANC's growth, the ANC's survival, not the growth, the ANC's survival and the survival of its partners depends on compromising on ideology. And that's the 64 million rand question, is whether that can happen, because without it, by being amenable and to stop this sort of literally ancient mistrust of business, it's actually very, very sad, because it really doesn't actually have anything to offer.
No, it doesn't make a lot of sense anyway. You know, I mean, I can hear where you're coming from. It's profound what you're saying. It's essentially ideological changes in people and the environments that they have to survive in, really, which have to evolve in order to meet the needs of what's most needed. Sarah, we have to move on to our next feature. Thank you so much for joining us. That was a great conversation. I hope you'll come and join us again.
With pleasure.